Welcome to the Canada in Geneva podcast, recorded from the permanent mission of Canada to the multilateral organizations in Geneva, Switzerland. This bilingual podcast features conversations in multilateral diplomacy with Canadian and other experts from the multilateral community. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you enjoy this episode. Bienvenue au balado du Canada à Genève. Enregistré depuis la mission permanente du Canada auprès des organismes multilatéraux à Genève, en Suisse. Ce balado, bilingue, présente des conversations sur la diplomatie multilatérale avec des experts canadiens et d'autres spécialistes de la communauté multilatérale. Merci de nous écouter et nous espérons que vous apprécierez cet épisode. Welcome et bienvenue to a new episode of the Canada in Geneva broadcast, Le Canada à Genève, balado diffusion bilingue, trying to focus on Canadian foreign policy issues in a Geneva context. And we like to think that we have very discerning listeners, but we have set the bar high with our guest today, Ambassador Jacqueline O'Neill, who is Canada's Women, Peace and Security Ambassador. It's a new post, and we're really excited to have her join us in conversation today from Canada. Hi, Jackie, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tamara. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we thought we'd start to look back briefly. I've always really loved the feminist mantra, you can't be what you cannot see. But in some ways, I think you turned that on its head in becoming Ambassador for Women, Peace and Security, because I imagine that there weren't a lot of ambassadors for Women, Peace and Security in your environment as you set out on your journey. So it would be very interesting to hear on the path that you chose and how you arrived at those choices. And I guess particularly thinking about some of our listeners who might be charting their own international careers, because you've come at this from both inside and outside formal diplomatic circles. And so to be an ambassador, but having had your own individual background is an interesting experience. So I'd love to hear some of your comments on that.
All right. Thanks so much. And hi to everybody listening. So as you said, I'm in Canada now. I'm speaking to you from Ottawa, Ontario, the traditional unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg people. But I grew up just outside of Edmonton, Alberta, which for some of the listeners who may not know is located in the west of Canada and is the northernmost city in North America with a population of over a million people. So you are indeed right. I did not grow up thinking that I could be an ambassador or that having this dream job would be something that I could achieve. I went to the University of Alberta. I got a Bachelor of Commerce because it seemed like it would be useful to learn how to read a balance sheet and, you know, have some kind of knowledge about money and how it all worked. But very long story short, I realized that my heart was just not in the private sector. So I ended up going to graduate school for public policy. And while I was doing that, I had two really transformational experiences. So one, I was a research assistant for Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire, who was the UN force commander in Rwanda during the genocide. And he was really interested in the issue of child soldiers, having faced them in Rwanda and not known from a military perspective, how to respond. And so I supported his work and spent a lot of time at the intersection of military communities and human rights communities, and obviously saw challenges, but mostly a lot of opportunities about working together. And so that was one of them. The second one is that I also spent some time living in Khartoum, Sudan. So I spent several months in Khartoum working 3 days a week at the new UN peacekeeping mission, and 3 days a week at the very busy campus of Afad, which is Sudan's only all-women university. And North and South Sudan had just signed a peace deal that had put an end to the 30 years of brutal war. There was a new transitional government that was planning to write a constitution and reform the armed forces and the entire civil service. And of course, keep spreading the word across the country about the content of this very new peace agreement. And it was a really exciting and very hopeful time. And yet, women from all parts of Sudan were really struggling to be engaged. So they were largely excluded from the formal peace negotiations. And in this next phase, they were struggling to get to tables where commissions were made, or decisions, excuse me, were made. So they were trying to get on, you know, the Defense Commission, the Civil Service Commission, and they were really, really having trouble even getting representation there. And it was just so clear to me, day to day, working with them in and out on all kinds of issues, that they had the strengths, the perspectives, the connections, and the wisdom that was really needed for the agreement to take root, and that would give it actually deep roots that would be a chance for it to succeed. And yet they really had to struggle. Women from all parts of society had to struggle just to get their voices heard. And they, I saw them kind of devoting a lot of brain power just to be on, you know, parliamentary committees or shaping donor priorities and all of this. And so I saw really up close the immense capacity that they had. You know, they didn't need training or empowerment. They just needed to be listened to and some space to organize. And so Sudanese and South Sudanese women really forever shaped my understanding about who belongs at peace tables and about the roles that all of us, including those of us in the so-called international community, the roles that we play in removing barriers that diverse women face to getting there. So I was fortunate to be able to keep working with them. And then over the next 13 years, I was based in Washington, D.C., and I worked for an organization called the Institute for Inclusive Security. And just very briefly, we described our work as focusing on women, peace, and security, working on both the supply side and the demand side. So on the demand side, we did a lot of advocacy to policymakers in Geneva, at the UN, at many other places, really trying to impress upon people why it matters to have women meaningfully included in peace processes, to convince them through research about how these talks or constitutional processes or national dialogues, how they could be structured, and to create really strong frameworks like high impact national action plans on women, peace, and security. And then on the supply side, we supported hundreds of women peace builders through a network. And the idea was basically that no one could ever say again, you know, we would love to have included some women, but there just weren't any who were, you know, interested or qualified, et cetera, because we were hearing that quite regularly. So we said, well, here's this list. And yeah, so it was a great opportunity to really get to work alongside and figure out ways that I could try to be useful to women in countries around the world who were leading their own work and try to find out how sort of my space in this could work. And it's just been a great pleasure to be able to do that since then. And then now, of course, in this
C'est
wonderful job.
Tout à fait passionnant d'entendre ce parcours. Et ce serait intéressant aussi de savoir si tu as encore des liens dans le Sud-Soudan, vu les événements récents et leur capacité de préserver cette place à la table. Et on entend beaucoup ce discours ici à Genève, notamment. Il y a quelques femmes tout à fait exceptionnelles qui travaillent dans ce domaine, notamment dans le contexte constitutionnel, ou si je peux dire pré-constitutionnel en Syrie, essayer de trouver une place à la table pour les femmes. Mais aussi, il y a une femme remarquable qui a participé au processus de paix en Irlande et qui, encore aujourd'hui, peut montrer la place pour les droits de la personne dans le contexte irlandais, la nouvelle gouvernance irlandaise depuis les accords de paix. Et la place tout à fait centrale des droits de la personne que elle et ses co-combattantes à la table ont pu consolider. Donc, de cette expérience, on arrive donc à la création, il y a quelques années, donc c'était en 2017, la création du poste d'ambassadrice pour Femmes, Paix et Sécurité au Canada.
2018.
2018, voilà, d'accord. Oui. Je me souviens, j'étais à Ottawa. Donc, on divise la vie en périodes selon les affectations. Donc, j'imagine, je ne sais pas, je ne suis pas dans le secret des dieux, mais j'imagine que tu as eu un peu d'influence sur la création du poste. Donc, peut-être parler un petit peu du rôle pour une ambassadrice canadienne dans ce domaine et quels sont pour toi les progrès qu'on a pu marquer ces dernières trois ans et demi, presque 4 ans?
Alors, vous êtes correct que c'était annoncé en 2018 et j'ai commencé dans ce rôle en 2019. Alors, ça fait plus ou moins deux ans et demi. Et je peux peut-être expliquer comment ça s'est arrivé que le Canada a nommé quelqu'un, a créé cette position et nommé quelqu'un. Comme vous savez très bien, la question des femmes, la paix et la sécurité est depuis longtemps importante pour le Canada. Alors, il y a 21 ans, la dernière fois que le Canada a siégé au Conseil de sécurité des Nations Unies, Et nous avons travaillé avec plusieurs pays, notamment la Namibie, le Bangladesh, le Jamaïque, pour soutenir l'adoption de la résolution 1325, qui, que vous savez bien, est l'appel initial et fondamental à ce que les femmes soient pleinement engagées dans tous les aspects de la paix et la sécurité. Nous avons maintenant une politique étrangère féministe, et tout comme près de 100 autres pays, nous avons maintenant un plan d'action national sur les femmes, la paix et la sécurité. Alors, nous avons lancé le premier en 2011 et le plan actuel en 2017. Et ce poste n'était pas prévenu dans le plan d'action national, mais le Canada a une société civile très dynamique qui a longtemps été des leaders sur les femmes, paix et sécurité. Et ils ont appelé pour une championne dédiée. Et le Parlement a adopté une motion pour créer le poste d'une ambassadrice pour cette position. Alors, à l'été 2019, le premier ministre Trudeau m'a nommée pour un poste de 3 ans avec mission de conseiller le gouvernement sur la mise en œuvre de notre plan d'action national, faisant preuve de leadership mondial dans ce domaine. Alors, je suis rattachée à notre ministère des Affaires mondiales, mais le mandat concerne 8 ministères et une agence fédérale, ce qui signifie qu'il s'étend au travail international et national, qui est très important. Et surtout, nous reconnaissons que les femmes, la paix et la sécurité est un concept qui est profondément pertinent chez nous, ainsi qu'à l'étranger, et que les femmes au Canada, en particulier les femmes autochtones, sont toujours confrontées à des obstacles majeurs, à l'égalité, dans tous les domaines de la paix et la sécurité. Alors, fondamentalement, j'essaie d'être une multiplicatrice de force, pour utiliser une terme de nos collègues militaires, une multiplicatrice de force pour les efforts de tout le gouvernement. Alors, j'essaie de faire 3 choses principales. Premièrement, de renforcer et élargir le réseau des 9 partenaires de mise en œuvre de notre plan d'action. Alors, donc, la promotion de plus de gens qui travaillent là-dessus et plus de monde qui travaille ensemble. Deuxièmement, j'essaie d'aider des gens à travers le gouvernement à obtenir des outils, des ressources et des conseils personnalisés. C'est-à-dire que même si vous croyez en l'égalité des genres, ce n'est pas évident que vous savez forcément comment intégrer le genre dans une analyse de conflit ou une stratégie de cybersécurité ou un processus d'approvisionnement. Ça doit être spécifique et très très clair pour tout le monde dans leur travail jour à jour. Et troisièmement, j'ai des initiatives importantes canadiennes. J'essaie de les aider à réussir. Alors, aider à façonner et à attirer attention à des initiatives comme l'initiative ELSI pour les femmes dans le maintien de paix ou des campagnes pour reconnaître, soutenir, inclure et protéger des femmes qui consolident la paix. C'est le hashtag paix au féminin, hashtag peace by her. Et même essayer de soutenir nos collègues qui faisant des choses comme diriger des groupes d'amis de femmes, paix et sécurité, comme le Canada fait à Genève, par exemple. Et veiller à ce que nous apprenions des personnes avec qui nous travaillons dans le monde entier. C'est extrêmement important que nous continuons à faire preuve d'humilité dans cet travail. Nous n'avons pas toutes les réponses. Nous essayons d'être des leaders, mais c'est essentiel de le faire avec d'humilité parce que j'apprends chaque jour de nos collègues de tout partout dans le monde. Et en fait, c'était l'Union africaine qui a été la première à avoir un envoyé spécial de haut niveau sur les femmes paix et sécurité. Alors, je dis des fois que nous avons copié, le Canada a copié l'Union africaine dans cette position.
C'est excellent, absolument. C'est bon de le rappeler. And thank you also for the reminder. It's that time of year. There are several campaigns that coincide and hopefully can be force multipliers as well. The Peace by Her campaign that you've referenced, which also comes at the same time as the 16-day campaign, the White Ribbon campaign against gender-based violence. And there's some connections there that we can build on and leverage in our diplomatic engagement. So really struck by the clear message in all that you do of the importance of the comprehensive approach, the cross-cutting, pulling together different strands, the domestic and the international. There's a daily reminder of that. We see that human rights, and I think in particular on all indigenous rights issues, that interplay is so important. And I think strengthens our message also, as we engage with other countries.
Indeed, and if I can I just say really briefly on that, I think I often call it sort of the dirty secret of national action plans has been for a long time. It's not a secret, but that there have been two different types. There have been plans that have been for so-called conflict-affected countries where there is a focus internally. And then there have been plans by largely donor countries where
Yes.
women, peace, and security is seen as a concept that is for foreign and defense policy. And we've seen over the last 5-ish years much more of a coming together of those two. And I think it's to your point, it's really essential for our learning. We have so much to learn from Indigenous women in Canada, from women around the world. We really constantly have to be recognizing ways we need to improve internally. And it's also important for our credibility. And we have so many partners and colleagues who say, we want to work with you on this, and we know that you're doing some things well, but you have to look within your own Canadian armed forces, within your own communities, and recognize that there is room for improvement. And I think much more than that being a sign of weakness, I think it helps us come from a position of strength, of not trying to be defensive about anything where we do need to improve, but actually opening ourselves up, being really honest and humble about where we have shortcomings and where we need to learn, being really open-minded about who we need to learn from. And expanding the conversation to make sure that we're really not just thinking of it in very kind of siloed ways. And I think it's the future of women, peace, and security and national action plans is to view these tenets as something that apply to all of us. The idea that the best decisions result when the people who are most directly affected by them have a say in making them. That's the core of women, peace, and security. And then the idea that it's on all of us to remove barriers to that happening, is, I think, the direction that we all need to go and hopefully are going.
Absolutely. I think we've never received as positive feedback from our international partners as when we have stood up, acknowledged failings and shortcomings on in the area of Indigenous rights in particular, but then emphasized that it has our realization of those failings and shortcomings has only redoubled our desire to work with our international partners and to implement international norms as part of the solution, as part of reconciliation. And that is when people, it is a really compelling message, and it's quite, I hope, helpful in making inroads with those who don't share our perspectives on those issues and who are not necessarily as open themselves to that international scrutiny and engagement. So, and it's so important to show across the board on the Women, Peace and Security file that it is not a sign of weakness. It is not a weakness to try and bring in other voices to the table. In some ways, it's deeply subversive, just like riding a bicycle is subversive as well. It's about changing power dynamics or changing how those power dynamics are perceived. And that's what makes it so compelling. I have to say, personally, as a diplomat, it's why I find the feminist foreign policy so exciting, because it ties everything together. And it's sort of a misnomer to talk about foreign policy. It's everything's interconnected, even when we get to the Sustainable Development Goals. There, too, I think there's been a tendency for people to think, oh, that's something that, you know, that affects some other part of the world. It's not me. One has to hope that that be one of the positive lessons that we come out of the pandemic with, is that it's all interconnected. So we have to find a way to engage with others in other countries. So looking ahead, what are next steps? Where do you go from here? As you get to the end of your mandate, what do you hope for?
So many things. As we mentioned, we're in our second national action plan right now. It ends in 2022. So we've started a process of consultations and engagements, both internally within Canada, within our own departments, and then externally with partners and activists and women peace builders from around the world to draft our next one. And we had what I think is a pretty remarkable meeting in June. We had 10 ministers come together, our chief of the defense staff, the head of our Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They came together specifically to talk about women, peace and security. They looked at how to finish strong in our current plan, and then also to the next one, to confirm we wanted one and to give some direction to all of us working on it about elements that they wanted to see. And indeed, they told us to focus on things like the domestic work, so expanding our domestic attention to this. As I mentioned, we have 9 partners. That includes 2 departments that focus on services and relationships with Indigenous Canadians. But we also have the Department of Justice, Immigration. We have Women and Gender Equality Canada. We have a range of other departments that have both domestic and international areas of focus. So more domestic focus, increasing the number of partners. We're very much hoping that other departments such as Veterans Affairs Canada might be able to be part. So looking at the full cycle of women who serve our country in military capacities and through our armed forces, and how their needs are also different and distinct sometimes afterwards, after they leave. We're looking at trying to increase more focus on climate justice. And climate change and climate security generally, and recognizing that there are gendered dimensions to that work. Certainly making sure it is reflective of the intersectional nature of so many women who do this work. So making sure that we continue to resist the idea that women are a homogenous group, and that we can say we have people from this region, then we have women. No, we want to say we have engaged, you know, women from rural areas, from urban areas, from different ethnicities, religions, ages, etc., to really be as attentive as possible and collecting data as possible about how well we are reaching a broad group. We want it to be anti-racist. So, you know, as countries around the world, because of the attention called or, you know, brought to this by activists, have, I think, really been doing a lot of self-reflection about the ways that we have systemic racism within our own institutions, in the way that we work, and sometimes in the way that we also think about our engagement with the rest of the world. So we want our next national action plan to be even more consciously anti-racist. We want to focus on women peace builders. That's why we had, as you mentioned, this campaign, Peace by Her. The idea was really to keep shining a light on the work that women at grassroots levels, at community levels, are doing to prevent conflict, which doesn't always get the attention that it deserves. Prevention writ large, you know, to work on disarmament, to work on a whole range of issues, and make sure that they get attention, that they're supported, including financially, that we as Canada are including them in any way that we have control over. and that they're protected because we're seeing a real increase in resistance to this work. We're seeing an increase in attacks on human rights defenders, people who are working to defend rights of women, LGBTQ people, growing nationalism, you know, this narrowing of identities and a rejection of differences. So we're seeing a lot of global trends that are also very concerning, and making sure that we're really centering diverse women peace builders in the work that we have going forward, and engaging them in how best to counter this, or as the head of UN Women used to say, to push back on the pushback that we're facing. So I'm really hoping we have a strong next national action plan. And something that I'm very, very proud of that Canada has done, and I can say that with pride because it was done before I started in this position, but when in our current national action plan, we have an official role for civil society. So we have an advisory group that is co-chaired by the government and by a representative of a network of women, peace and security organizations and people focused on the issue in Canada, so Canadian network. And it's been really, really important. We set the agenda together for meetings. They help make sure that, you know, we know they're going to hold us accountable. They give us insights on what they think is going well, what's not. They help us focus. We pick certain issues to focus on. We do an annual report to Parliament, and then we meet with them to discuss findings and try to give it a little more texture, et cetera. And no matter what, I'm quite certain that we will continue that relationship with civil society in a way that's not ad hoc, but really built into the system so that they have some predictability as well about when we'll be reaching out, what are, you know, how they can engage ideas for or a consistent way of channeling their input into our thinking, which has been really incredibly useful. And I'm certain we'll carry on regardless of the structure of the next plan. I shouldn't say I'm certain. I'm very hopeful it would carry on regardless of the structure of the next plan.
Well, and it's that built-in inclusiveness that is what makes this kind of policy so strong. But it's so interesting to hear. One of the other appealing elements, it's the almost constant portrayal of women and other groups as decision makers and not as victims. They're participating and they're making things happen and shaping society, maybe making mistakes as well, but they're full actors.
It'd be stunning if they didn't. I mean, we all do. Right?
Yeah.
We all do.
Exactly. Exactly. But it's a nice sort of upending of some of the some of the older perspectives on feminism, for sure. It's even feminism can do with an upgrade. also just focusing on what has been prevented. That's the eternal challenge in human rights, is proving a negative. Let's tell you about the atrocities that might have happened had we not been there, had we not had the norms.
Yes, and how much it would have cost had we not been doing this.
Yes.
Yeah. One of my dreams is to have a really intensive study on the cost of exclusion, because I think sometimes we see, you know, changing policies, changing norms, building facilities for women to serve alongside men. It's, you know, all kinds of things, or adding chairs at the table. We see it as an added cost. And I think we need to flip that around and say, what is the cost to our organization of not being attentive in our hiring practices in ways that will ensure that we have much more representative personnel, or, you know, in conflict prevention, you know, what is the cost of being exclusive in the way that we structure our systems? And who knows how much traction we get with those numbers, but I think there really is one. And I think that's the discourse, the part of the way the discourse needs to be flipped, and not away from, I think we're getting there, but we need to get away from women making the case as to why they belong. I mean, first of all, it's their right to be there, so they should, but the burden should be on institutions, on us, to explain why we still have barriers that prevent them from doing so.
Absolutely. I think that's the Bachelor of Commerce grad coming through, looking to that balance sheet. But I think that is how we're going to be able to push back against the pushback, is developing that positive narrative of how much the alternative costs a society. And we're getting there. I see it quite a bit in our talking points about how, you know, excluding half of society is going to be, it literally will be a zero-sum game for an economy. And as we look at COVID recovery, that's got to be a central part of the equation. But I think more broadly in terms of norms and rights, it's on us to try and develop that positive narrative. And we certainly in Geneva, we are faced with it constantly and are always interested in ways to try and build on it. But again, our policy approach has been a big help. It gives us something to be able to point to and something constructive. So as we haven't been able physically to have you visit Geneva yet, and we've had a few obstacles to that, it's great to be able to have you at least have your voice here and to share some of your thoughts. Just a bonus question, if I may. I'm always interested to hear what people are reading or what's on their reading list. I just went back into, I think, again, my undergrad reading lists and pulled out Garrett Mattingly's The Spanish Armada and reread that, which is a bit of a detour through a lot of nautical terminology. But there's only two women who feature in that book. The first one, of course, loses her head literally right at the beginning. So she, although her spirit continues to have an impact on the battles that ensued. But the other woman, of course, is Elizabeth I, who is an interesting model in the women, peace, and security angle, who sought all her life to balance the role of a woman in a man's world. And not all of it stands up to 21st century scrutiny, but it was certainly a pleasurable read. And I've always admired Elizabeth I, so it was sort of my retro reading for the month of November. But what maybe you have something a little more up to date to recommend.
Wow, that's great. I've never read that, and now I will. I mean, on this topic, which I is where my mind is at the moment, I'll name two if I can cheat and do two.
Excellent.
So one is a book called Sex and World Peace, and it's by a woman called Dr. Valerie Hudson. And she led a research project. You've probably heard the data that, you know, the single biggest determinant of whether a country goes to war with itself or with its neighbors is not its GDP, it's not its location in the world or its neighborhood or its ethno-religious affiliation, et cetera. It's whether women are able to access their rights. So how women are treated. And so she talks about the connections and the linkages. Some correlation, some causality between various factors and, you know, how sex and gender relate to world peace. And I think she just lays it out very clearly.
And it's a catchy title.
Yeah, exactly. It is. She knew what she was doing. The other one is called Seven Fallen Feathers. It's written by a Canadian woman named Tanya Talaga. And she chronicles the individual stories and points out the connections between the individual examples and stories of Indigenous Canadians who've experienced residential schools, relates to our crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and really takes the headlines that you read about it and brings it to life in a beautiful and sad but really dignified way. So Seven Fallen Feathers by Tanya Talaga.
Great suggestions.
Big range there for something for everyone, I hope, in that list.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you so much for sharing your insights today. It's been such a pleasure. And I hope that we'll get to connect in person very soon. But failing that, it's been a pleasure to chat.
Thank you so much for having me. And I will really hope to get to Geneva as soon as I can. You've got so many great, you've referred to it previously as a great ecosystem in Geneva. And I can't wait to get there and meet and see more of you in person. But thank you for this opportunity to connect virtually.